Security, The Final Frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Healthy Paranoia. Its ongoing mission, to explore strange new nerds, to seek out new hacks and mitigations, to boldly go where no geek has gone before. Stardate, August 19th, 2012. At the helm, Mrs. Y, a.k.a. Michelle Chaburka, joined by Communications Officer and Chief Engineer Greg Farrow. Today, we've beamed up some very special guests to the bridge. Travis Good, hacker and makerspace fanboy extraordinaire. Ben Mendes, or Ben the Pirate, of local hackerspace HackDC. And Project Byzantium, and finally, Brad Barr, esteemed president of HackDC. Sir, please, ask your protective detail to step to the side so as not to impede the crew's operations. Mr. Farrow, could you please take us to Warp Factor 2 and set the nerd meter to mind-boggle? And please, keep our guests away from the tricorder. We need it to check for sentient life forms at the management level.
We should. My goodness. Oh, goodness me. Well, there's a hell of an intro, Michelle. Thank you very much. I'm Greg Farrow. As some of you might know, I'm the sometime host of the Packet Pushers podcast. I'm looking forward to dropping in because this is all about security, which is not my primary skill, although I just pretend most of the time.
And you're very opinionated for somebody who pretends.
never let knowledge get in the way of a solution.
Well, this is something a little unusual because I have a personal love for hacker and maker spaces, but I'm betting a lot of people, a lot of our listeners, don't know what a hacker or a maker space is. So, of course, I went to Urban Dictionary, and what I found, and maybe everybody who actually represents hacker spaces and maker spaces can correct me, a facility to incubate nerds and equip them with tools. That sounds really dangerous to me.
Or fun, depending upon your perspective.
Currently found in all major cities, hackerspaces exist to pool nerds' resources together and enable them to build and invent ever newer and better things. Most hackerspaces are equipped with rapid prototyping machines, 3D printers, laser cutters, metal milling tools, welding, electronics, and millinery. How does everybody feel about that definition for our listeners?
It feels pretty straight on. It's interesting that in this definition of hackerspaces, it actually talks about making better things, because there kind of was an evolution from working with primarily software to now including a whole lot more that has to do with working with actual hardware, made largely possible by the low price points and power of the kind of tools you enumerated there, the 3D printers, laser cutters, etc. But largely, I agree with it.
Brad, feelings?
Yeah, I completely agree with that definition. It lacks the community aspect that I like to talk about when I speak about hackerspaces. Hackerspaces aren't just there to build things, but they're also there for community between different nerds and folks who want to build and break things together. So I think that's really important, but wasn't touched upon. But in terms of everything else, it sounds perfect.
Ben?
Yeah, I was going to, kind of echo that. I think one of the biggest assets of a hackerspace is the knowledge pool and education.
That's what I enjoyed so much about. I have been to HackDC a couple of times, and you never know what kind of conversation you're going to have. I mean, I went to a Christmas party there, and it was hysterical because a guy came up with a loaf of, like, Wonder Bread. That was one of the, that was some of the food there. I think there was some beer, but the best part of it was not, the refreshments. It was, over in this corner, there were some guys talking about artificial intelligence, and over here there was, the 3D printer, and people were making snowflakes on it. It was like a modern Algonquin round table, I thought, of all kinds of varieties of people making things. And then, of course, there was the requisite lock picking going on in another corner. So hence kind of the security application. I'm sure a lot of people are going, well, what does a hackerspace have to really do with security? And what I find is that it fits more into the classical definition of being free from danger or threat, that when you can make things, you know, or improve what you already have better, then there's a sense of, you know, security and control and empowerment, which I think is what security is really about.
Well, and there's also another dimension which may be more particular to Northern Virginia, D.C. area than elsewhere, but most of the people, I'd say at least half or more of the people who are members of Nova Labs come from the InfoSec community. And it is really their desire to do things that are more in the physical world, more with their hands, more with tools, as a variety in their life, some added dimension that they end up joining this makerspace and being members. So it's really a sort of tangential relationship there. But it does bring out the fact that there's a certain magic to making things that you can have on the software side. But as you can do things with your hands, it's just another expression of that creativity. And to be in a community of people who feel the same way it's just a great thing.
I've found my time at Nova Labs really exciting as well. I mean, the packet parties once a week are great. I'm getting a message. Greg, did you hear that? Our esteemed colleague Ethan Banks wants to join in.
Hello, hello.
We've already started recording, but we've beamed you up to the bridge. Well, so one of the things that I found really interesting was, you know, I think a lot of people are going to make the assumption that hackerspaces are just very testosterone laden. You know, let's break something and build stuff with welding equipment. And what I found really amusing was a few weeks ago, somebody wanted to have a sewing workshop, and I thought that was great.
I was going to say there is some measure of truth to it being a male-dominated community. I've traveled around and I've been to 61 different makerspaces at this point, and it's usually a point of interest when there are a few ladies there. And yet some people really, by design, reach out in the direction of doing things that are going to diversify the community. And I think the biggest example I saw that was in sort of the professional version of a makerspace, which is Tech Shop out in San Francisco, where they perhaps have 50% of their membership as ladies. And not to sound stereotypical here, but their strategy for having done that was to insert sewing, embroidery machines, the silk screening, etc. But that was just sort of like the tease to get it started, because what happens when you get all these creative people together in a place with lots of tools and the desire to collaborate is you start finding out hybrids where you're taking a little bit of silk screening and sandblasting and frosting glasses, or you're taking a little bit of embroidery and you're using it around an Arduino project that you created that, you know, nobody would have ever done before with LEDs if they had just been a seamstress in the past. So the community starts to become more diversified where there's a deliberate attempt. At least that's what I've found. And that's personally our experience in North Virginia, to actively seek some diversity. And after you reach a certain level and you've got your sewing and your other classes that seem to work to draw in variety, then it starts to just become a nice mix. But it is a testosterone-biased community overall, yes.
Well, I mean, I felt very welcomed in Hack DC and in by Nova Labs. I mean, so let's talk about what are some of the typical projects that you might find in a hackerspace. And by the way, which name do all of you prefer? Do you prefer hackerspaces or makerspaces? I've heard both.
Oh, man. I think Hack DC is kind of a hybrid space. It's more maker than hacker, but I like hackerspace.
Okay. Yeah, I also like hackerspace.
Yeah, I like hackerspace within the community. When I'm talking to people outside of the community, the press has done so much to tarnish the term that sometimes I won't use it as my first descriptor. But I certainly, in my heart, feel more biased towards the hackerspace.
Is it? It would have. I've often thought about this word hacker, and you know, cracker is evil, and hacker is a force for good. But the world actually gets afraid of people who are smarter than everybody else. And
that's
hackers are often smart, and so there's often a fear that smart people might do something that, you know, whatever. people have the same problem with, you know, lawyers. They're too smart, so we're always suspicious of a lawyer.
Well, we have other problems with lawyers.
But I mean, well, from my point of view, I always wanted to come up with a better term than the word hacker, because hacker's sort of been, you know, but maker is a good word as well, and that's one that Boing Boing uses a lot, is a hacker is a maker, and a maker can be a hacker. Kind of people who make stuff, that's what it's about.
Yeah, I like all the different words that sort of describe what we do. We tinker, we take apart, we make, we tweak. There's so many things that could be used. That, I mean, it's sort of like those two terms, hackerspace and makerspace, have made it into the mainstream. And I think that just in terms of palatability, makerspace seems to be one that people can more readily glom onto and feel good about. I think spirit between all the communities that use the different terms is fairly similar. We're all creatively wanting to express ourselves using these tools and collaborate around projects. And it's, I think the spirit is very similar, regardless of what you call it and what the primary activities are.
Well, let's talk about some of the projects. What are, Ben, Brad, what are some of the typical projects that from HackDC that I'd see?
Ben, you want to go ahead? Start.
Sure. So right now, my primary focus has been on Project Byzantium, which is a project to bring mesh networking to the masses. We're trying to make it reliable and easy to use so that, you know, typical people can create a mesh network in an emergency to communicate. And that's, you know, but this is just one of the many projects at HackDC. We've also done really cool stuff like launch space blimps, you know, with weather balloons. And we've had all kinds of classes. We've played with lasers.
What was the one with the donut? Was it a donut or a cupcake? I forget.
Oh, the entered Hackerspace Cupcake Challenge?
Yeah, talk about that. That was hysterical.
That was adorable. We were supposed to bake a very tasty homemade cupcake and ship it across the nation and make sure it arrived unscathed, which wound up not working at all, and ours arrived very scathed, but still tasty. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Every once in a while, we try and participate in collaborations like that between hackerspaces. Yeah.
That sounds like my engineering degree. When I was many years ago, when I was at university, we had this grumpy old civil engineering lecturer, and he said, "Right, all you lot, you're all miserable engineers. You've got to show me that you know what a bridge looks like and how it works. So your project for the next 12 weeks is to build something that can take this bar of soap and lodge it into that bucket of water over there. Don't care how you do it. Just got to do it, and, you know, a bunch of rules and everything like that." That's exactly the same thing as my engineering degree, shipping a cupcake from one side of the Except I was getting credit for it, and I hated it, by the way, because it was civil engineering. I never really got along with the civil engineers, I must say. Which, that's so cool.
Well, what's Travis, what are some of the projects that at Nova Labs? I mean, I can talk about them, but since you're one of the co-founders, it's
Well, you know, what's interesting is that the space itself has been a project. You know, we only got together and formed the place back in November, and so we've been building out rooms, we've been establishing classes, we've been writing documentation for training, we've been fleshing out the place, and the place itself has been a major project. But I don't know why it is, but we seem to have also pulled off an awful lot of classes. So everything from soap making and beer making to EagleCAD, and there's an Android Arduino series that we've done. We have regular like LAN parties and packet parties. We have lock picking groups. Probably my favorite, though, is one that we didn't know where it was going to go. We just said electronics prototyping was the theme, and somebody was going to put together a series that people would come in and start building prototyping. So we ended up with a wide variety of things. We ended up with Arduinos as the core engine for these things, but we had everything from a guy who is sampling the moisture in his plants, and depending upon whether the soil is moist enough or not, having a little LED array smile or frown. Frowning meaning he needs to water it. Another person's come in and is automatically scoring a dart game. So he's got these lovely darts, you know, that you see in pubs and that sort of thing. And just by where the dart lands, it automatically knows how to score. And so, again, Arduino is at the core. And in common with all of this is this curriculum that says, you know, here are the basics of EagleCAD, and here's how you design some things in SketchUp, and it leads into classes on laser cutter and things like that so that people can start making their housings and that sort of thing. But we didn't know where it was going to go. It just seems to have taken on a life of its own. And that's one of the things I just love so much about Makerspaces is some people get around something and they're enthusiastic. And because they are predisposed to making, they actually bring it to life. And that's got to be one of the most gratifying things of being a part of this, not the least of which, in addition, is learning from people. One day you're teaching somebody something. The next 5 days you're learning from four other people. It's a really great collaborative environment. And I think that prototyping class is a good example of how it plays out, if you let it.
Well, I liked what Brad said. I liked what you said about community, that being one of the key areas, because I always feel very welcomed when I go to one of these spaces. Nobody's ever made me feel stupid. I mean, somebody sitting down and talking to me about artificial intelligence, you know, I don't really understand. I understand at a very high level what it is, but actually sitting down and showing me the programming of how it might work, I just was dumbfounded that, you know, somebody would take the time to do that with me. And, you know, the packet parties, which I've taken advantage of at Nova Labs, you know, are a great time where some of the people who have malware reverse engineering experience will sit down and go through what they do, you know, their thought process for taking something apart. I mean, it's great. I always feel like I've learned so much that my head is ready to explode after I leave one evening.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your take on it? What are some of the classes that you're offering at HackDC? Because I know at one time you were offering an artificial intelligence class.
Right.
What else?
So we did offer artificial intelligence for a long time, but Singularitarians overran it and kind of made it into this weird Kurzweil party, so we stopped doing that. We teach classes on a bunch of things. A lot of our workshops are open-ended, much like the prototyping class, so people will show up with their own projects and just kind of work on things. We have a day specifically for hardware and a day specifically for software. We also have craft afternoons on the weekends every first Sunday, I think. We've been teaching classes in everything from fine arts to programming. So the most recent classes that have happened at HackDC were some one-off classes through Knowledge Commons DC, another teaching organization in the district, about like cybersecurity and how to be safe online, as well as introduction to programming. We taught a few classes at Artisphere in Arlington to interactive artists about Arduinos and about the processing environment. We'll be teaching a class in September on lockpicking. And yeah, there's just a whole bunch of things that happen.
Yeah, if I could plug real quick, I'm going to be offering another class. It's The Element of Computing Systems, based on a book by Shimon Shakin and Noam Neeson. And I've offered this twice before at HackDC, and it was a great hit, so I'm going to offer that again. But also right now we have a study group going on for structured interpretation of computer programs, which, if you're familiar with the MIT class, it's very, very rigorous. And you kind of come away from that with your head feeling like it's totally exploded with like all these new ideas about computer science and how thinking works.
Well, you're making it so accessible to everybody, because I worked with a guy at the university, and you know, he's a network engineer, but he has a background in political science. And he joined the class. He'd just start going, and he thought it was great. Because he didn't have that, you know, very traditional computer science or electrical engineering background. So he found it really helpful to go out and you know, he didn't feel talked down to, and he really enjoyed himself. It was great.
There's the accessibility of all these classes, but another dimension to it that kind of fascinates me is how the classes are determined. I mean, they're determined, at least in a lot of the situations I've seen, by what people are interested in. So we had a guy who just loves his MakerBot. And, of course, since we have MakerBots available in the space, people are always anxious to learn about it. He came up with a class, Care and Feeding of Your MakerBot. And it was just like all the background that you want.
Wait, Travis, what's a MakerBot for those of us?
I'm sorry. There's one brand of 3D printer out there by MakerBot Industries, and actually the ones that we have are called Thingamatics. There have been three different models, and these are the technology that is additive, where you simply start from the ground up, and by very carefully laying down a little bit of plastic, you build 3D objects. And so a MakerBot is just an amazing tool that tends to blow people's mind. You don't do a whole lot of practical, useful stuff with them yet, but they are really an imagination grabber. And so people wanted to have access to it, and this guy happens to love it, and he turned it into a class based on his passion for it. Same thing with laser cutting. One guy has already done a DIY laser himself, and so we made him the steward of our laser. People wanted to know what more they could do than just simple straight cuts. And he came up with a whole myriad of different things and put it on. We had 36 people show up, and we didn't expect to have more than 20. As a matter of fact, I capped the meetup.com registration at 24. We still had 36 show up. So when you can tap into a vein of passion on both the part of the presenter and the community at large, some wonderful things happen.
So why do you guys do this? What do you think the potential is for this? What's your sort of – what drives you to participate in hackerspaces?
That's an interesting question. I often wander around our hackerspace and ask our active participants, like, why are they there? Why do they hack? And a lot of the times it's for, like, two different reasons. One is because they want to see the world more open in terms of open source and in terms of just knowledge. So they just want to be able to take apart everything they own and put it back together. And some even find it insulting, the fact that companies nowadays they'll lock down things so hard that you won't even be able to, like, open the box, let alone understand what's inside. And people just don't like that, or at least in our community, they don't like that. And the second reason I hear all the time is because, like, people, like, have this innate drive. They don't know. They do it regardless of whether or not there's a hackerspace around, and because there is a hackerspace, they just want to be around like-minded people, and they want to work on things, and they want to do interesting things with their spare time. They just have to, is what they say. It's really fun.
Yeah, I mean, I was attracted to HackDC just because, you know, I wanted to be around other like-minded geeks, and I wanted to learn more about hardware and learn more about, like, parts of things in software that you don't get through traditional learning institutions. And once I got involved in the community, I found, like, I really had a passion to, like, share some of the experience that I had and share some of that knowledge, and I started running a class.
So when you guys want to get going and you try to you want to start up a space in your area, how do you get the word out? Is it just all on the ground, online, people that know each other online, then you find out you live close by and you meet up, or?
Well, I'll give you an answer that I've heard sort of play out time and time again, which is somebody has the motivation to actually try to get some group together and puts an ad in the paper or sets up a meetup.com group or somehow gets the message out. And people begin by just getting together occasionally at some free space. So they tend to have gone to a coffee shop that has Wi-Fi. They sit around. The group grows, or it doesn't grow. If it does grow, then they kind of reach this crescendo where they say, you know, maybe we should take a leap and find a space. Depending upon where you're located, that can be a lot easier or a lot more difficult than it sounds like on the surface, because D.C., for instance, is a very expensive real estate property area. But when it comes to the Midwest, you can find great spaces for next to nothing. So to go from that group of folk who find that they have a common interest after having met a bunch of times in some common area, a library, a pub, a coffee shop, whatever, getting to that next level is that it's sort of like people holding hands and deciding to jump off the cliff together, because they will have done the research on the market. They would have tried to figure out if they could generate the revenue, whether people could stand behind their commitments for funding, and whether they could bring the tools together. They'd sort of take that leap. And from that point then, if they have made that leap, you know, it's either grow crazy fast or not grow at all and fall apart, or maybe do both. The dynamics that play out in makerspaces, just because makers don't necessarily have great organizational skills in terms of businesses or you know, an operating concern, they can be all over the place. But the desire to get together around tools and to learn and to teach, and these core elements that you've been hearing here, a lot of people feel that. And especially in this age where the cost of personal fabrication technology has come down so much. It used to be that you'd have your amateur radio club, and you'd go to an amateur radio club, and that's what you'd do, amateur radio, or your carpentry group, or your whatever else group. Now, because of all these smart tools, the way you can go from software to realization through some of these CNC tools makes it so much more accessible that someone can actually learn how to do 3D printing, laser cutting, use a CNC mill, and produce stuff that not too long ago would have been just impossible without, you know, a decade worth of really good experience using those tools. So the environment has changed, and I think a lot of people have heard wind of this, and they lean forward with curiosity and interest, and if they find a group that's out there, then things go crazy. Our meetup group started off with just a handful back in March. We now have 175 people who have expressed an interest, and a surprising percentage of those people come to our open houses because there's just a latent interest out there that just needs to be tapped into.
Well, Travis, you mentioned a good point. You said that it can be really hard in certain areas, like in Northern Virginia. It's not too hard to find space, but in D.C., I mean, Ben, why don't you tell us where HackDC space is? Why don't you give us a little description of that?
So HackDC is located at in an office of St. Stephen's Church on 16th and Newton in Northwest. And it's, you know, I think it's a really great space. But, you know, when you come to this building, you see a church and you're not thinking, this is where I'm going to find a bunch of nerds.
Yeah, that was very strange to me the first time. I remember I'm friends with Will, and I dropped him off once. You're in a church? What? But, you know, in D.C. you have to be, I think, creative about space because it's not, you know, it's not always easy to find. I mean, let's go back a little. Can each of you tell us a little bit about your background? Because I know there some of it's a little different here. Ben, why don't you start?
My background, I guess I'm, you know, your average, like, you know, software programmer, like sysadmin-y nerd. I've been using, you know, Linux for a long time, and, I've always been interested in computers and stuff. I didn't quite finish college yet, so, I teach good computer science class, but I don't have a computer science degree yet. It's kind of funny.
Brad, what about you?
Oh, my background, I have a degree in arts and liberal arts. I have been using Linux forever. I did a bunch of robotics, which is actually why I moved to the area. Did autonomous robotics for NASA for a while. And now I'm just working the startup circuit around the area. I'm just doing regular software development sorts of things. But, yeah, I'm a crafter, a lockpick, all sorts of other things. Yeah.
Travis, you have probably the most interesting background, and I think everybody is going to make you their hero because I certainly want your life. I've said that before.
Well, with a lead up like that, I think I'll just say that relevant to this conversation, I spent several years as chairman of a small startup incubator, and that was a process that I really enjoyed being a part of. But as I stumbled across the maker movement and what was happening in hackerspaces, it just ginned me up. And I think what you're talking about, Michelle, is the whole notion that I do spend a lot of time running around visiting fab labs, makerspaces. I visit libraries that have makerspaces. I'm about to drive across the country right now, starting next Wednesday, visiting libraries along the way that are trying to get into the makerspace initiative by realizing their mission in a new way. I mean, there are ways by which schools are also embracing this because we've stepped so far away from kids putting hands on to things and learning how to grow intellectually by doing things with their hands, making stuff. And all these personal fabrication tools are making it possible to bring that back into schools. So many ways of learning. And I think makerspace allows for a whole different dimension of learning, people who learn best through doing can really flourish in a makerspace. So I just wanted to use, Ben, your example as a jump-off point for what I think is a really cool theme inside a makerspace. We've already talked about the education side of things, but it's just a whole nother way of learning for some people, and well, it's really valuable.
I like that because, I mean, Ethan, Greg, you both have kids, and I love when families get to take advantage of events at Maker and Hacker Spaces. In fact, I just talked to I have a friend, a woman friend. She teaches Wireshark classes around the country, and she was so depressed. She said, "Oh, I wish they had the Nova Labs where I live." And da 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 da. I don't understand. They have such great things. And so I went to hackerspaces.org. I said, come on, she lives in Atlanta. Of course they have it. And I found Free Space Atlanta. I sent it to her with a list of the classes. And she signed up with her daughter to take some of the classes. And I thought that was great. Not only so female nerds, and, and it's in the family. So I think that's great. So anybody out there, I really strongly support that for families.
Yeah, agreed. Completely.
Yeah.
I mean, to play off like what Travis said, if you've ever seen the movie Accepted, I think of HackDC a lot like South Harmon Institute, where, you provide a group of really enthusiastic, interested learners with all the tools and the space that they need to explore their ideas, and then just set them loose and see what they do.
Yes. Some great
nerds
stuff happens.
On the loose.
It's really remarkable.
Nerds on the loose. That can be really scary.
I have a problem in that I live 2 hours away from London. If I lived in London, I might be able to join in. But it's very difficult for me because I'm just not naturally a people person. And the idea of actually going to a meeting on a regular basis drives me batty. That would scare me off.
Ben, I don't think. What about Redbeard? He's not necessarily a people person.
Actually, I would say a huge percentage of makers are not people.
No, that's the best part. I mean, I love this guy. I mentioned Redbeard. You guys got to talk about him. He's hysterical. His name, it's not just a name. He really has a huge, long red beard.
He has an epically red beard. I think that he's not, I guess, most people person, but, he was our president for a year, and, he's a really, great, motivated guy, and he teaches classes. He's, he's willing to sit down with people sometimes and really, walk them through, but you're right. He's sometimes kind of, harsh if, your first time interacting with him.
He was fine. He was great with me. My friend Andrew, who went, also commented. He said, "That guy, Redbeard, he has the hugest beard." So, I mean, we've gone over some of the things that you might do there: 3D printing, fabrication. It goes from all extremes. I even suggested that I know a local chocolate maker, and I threw it out there. I said, "Hey, is anybody interested in having this chocolate maker come out and talk about things?" And everybody went, "Yeah." So, I mean, you might find any number of different projects in a maker or a hacker space.
Right.
But let's talk about some of the key concepts that Travis and I had this discussion. The economic development factor. I know that maker spaces and hacker spaces are becoming very prevalent in low-income societies in places like India, where they can empower themselves and take control and become not just sort of on the receiving end of a device or charity, but they can take charge themselves. There are opportunities in a recession for people to retrain. I thought that was really great. What do you guys think of that?
I think it's huge. I guess I spent 6 weeks in San Francisco at Tech Shop. And when I first went there, there were a variety of long-term unemployed who were coming there and trying to learn new skills, et cetera. These folks would, in the beginning, sort of have a conversation with you where their eyes were downcast, their shoulders were slumped, maybe their voice was a little bit weak. But as they learned how to use that mill and they started to produce their first work products, and then they started to see new ways that they combined different tools. You know, they got into vacuum form molding and maybe a little bit of sewing, and they created some sort of creation, and they were heading in the direction of Kickstarter. You could just see a huge change in who they were. I mean, they would just become more confident, eye contact. They would just be so much more self-assured, I think, is a word that comes out of making. If you make things, you're controlling your destiny. You're affecting the world around you. You're not just being affected by it. And it's really empowering, and it's great for self-confidence. So in an economic downturn, when people can experience something like that, it's really fantastic. And there's another dimension to this economic development, which is we have a huge swath of this country which has making in its DNA. I mean, the entire Midwest has been making for decades and decades, but they've been making on an old technology platform. There's so many more tools. They can get at so much more capability now if only given the opportunity. And at least one way they can do that is through makerspaces. So there's a lot of good that can come out of it in both the economic development and in the recession scenarios.
I mean, I feel, you know, personally, I'm hugely, supportive of this idea of empowering people through education and technology. And I'd really love to see more people come to HackDC and get empowered that way. And I've tried, but I'm just not sure. Like, I see it happen on a personal kind of level, but I'm not seeing it really happen on the kind of scale that I'd like to see.
Well, I like to bring up, I love, one of my heroes of this movement is Neil Gershenfeld. He's the founder of MIT Fab Labs. I mean, most people, the hacker guys, know who this is. And I like a quote. He said something about that sort of addresses empowerment. And he said, the other 5 billion people on the planet aren't just technical sinks. They are sources. The real opportunity is to harness the inventive power of the world to locally design and produce solutions to local problems. And I mean, that's the history of computing. That's the history of everything we do, of engineering. And that's, I think, what attracts me the most to the spaces. I mean, one of the most attractive projects to me has been Project Byzantium. I mean, Ben, can you talk a little bit about the history of that, go into a little more detail? That's a really great example, I think, of a makerspace, hackerspace project.
Sure. So Project Byzantium started, it actually started with Bradford, like, throwing together this collection of, like, you know, hackers from the community, made a call and had a code sprint about how can we address what's going on in Egypt. And at the time, it was, you know, Egypt had the uprising, the government had shut down the internet, and there was all this question about, you know, what was going on there, because it was difficult to get information out of the country because they had shut off the internet. And it scares a lot of us, you know, when we think about how reliant we are on having the internet. That's a really scary proposition, that a government could just flip a switch. So, you know, everyone got together and we started thinking, you know, shooting ideas and about what we can do, you know, to help them, or if this should happen again, to prevent it. And mesh networking was one of the ideas that got floated pretty early on. And after we did some research, because, you know, initially we were a bit skeptical, we found that this could really work, and we just kind of took off with it.
So why don't you go into a little of the detail? We have a very nerdy audience, so you can go into detail about what kind of things you use to enable
it. I was just reading the website for that, and it says the use cases for such a system would be, number 3, a zombie apocalypse in which the personnel responsible for maintaining key infrastructure would all have been turned.
Right. Oh, you giggle like that's not really going to happen.
Well,
you
know, I think hacker spaces are all about zombie apocalypses, thank you very much. I think that's the ultimate response.
Oh, well, we definitely are. If you've ever used the bathrooms in HackDC, you know that we have armory just in case. So,
yeah. So, if you want to go into some details about some of the components of Project Byzantium, I think our listeners would be very interested.
So we found that, you know, when we started researching this, we found that the technology to build a mesh network has been around for years. This has been an old problem that, you know, people have been looking into for more than 30 years now, maybe 40 years now. And the tools exist, but they're really difficult to use. We looked at a number of mesh networking protocols. We actually found there's more than 70 out there, but we narrowed it down to about 4 or 5 that we thought might be practical. And we had a sprint when we just tried setting them all up and seeing how they would perform and, you know, how difficult it was to get them to work. And we eventually settled on using the Babel mesh networking protocol because it operates entirely in user space. There's no additional kernel module to install, and it just works by manipulating the operating system's route table. So it's, you know, a pure layer 3 routing protocol that automates, you know, task of setting up static routes between, you know, between points in the network. And then on top of that, we built a control panel interface so that, you know, through your browser, through like a graphical interface, you can start up this mesh networking, configure everything, get it all online without ever having to open a command line. And we added in services like chat and Twitter and, you know, website hosting so that, you know, like a wiki, so that people can, you know, once you have this network up, even if there is no internet, you can still collaborate and communicate with other people.
So, for example, what kind of equipment did you use or would you use in this scenario?
Yeah, that was actually one of the interesting things is we thought, you know, well, it would be great if we could put this on, you know, a bunch of routers and, like, airdrop them into a country or something. And that's actually something that people hearing about the project have been, like, resuggesting to us again and again. But it turns out that airdropping routers is a really, really hard problem. There are a lot of other concerns, like, you know, how are you going to, you know, invade someone else's airspace and drop, you know, these airdrop routers on protesters? And if there's like, if there's a power outage, people are just going to take those. They're going to steal the batteries to charge their cell phones, which then, you know, they can't use their cell phone for anything because they disabled the mesh network that was giving them service.
Well, those Ciscos could hurt if that hit me on the head, so.
Right? What we decided was we want this to work with the equipment that they already have available to them, and that was, you know, a pure software solution that would run on, you know, your average x86 laptop, you know, or device that. So it's an x86 distribution, a bootable CD, bootable USB distribution that's easy to copy. You can make copies of it while the system's running. You can burn new CDs and copy it to more USBs. It's really easy to replicate. It's really easy to hack on. So that's our vision, is that, you know, people will, you know, at least one person has this. They make copies. They just pass it out to their friends. Minimal collusion, and you build a network organically.
So is anybody utilizing this so far? Is there any real world use of this that you know of?
There's been a lot of testing. We still don't recommend it as, you know, stable enough to risk people's lives on it. But in the D.C. area, when the wind blows a little strongly, the power tends to go out because Pepco fails. And
I've been subject to that. Yeah.
The last time this happened, it also took out cell networks and internet for several days in Montgomery County and parts of D.C. So we use this, you know, ourselves. We were dog fooding to get our office online and, you know, get, you know, members of our community online. So it actually has been used in, you know, very minor emergencies.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Any vibe on how many people could participate in the mesh? I mean, how large could you scale this out during a with a mesh network, everybody being – well, I was actually reading on the site before, too, and you said a gateway would be an inappropriate term to use for a mesh network, but everybody effectively acts as a point of relay where they can take traffic from somebody and push it out elsewhere. How many folks can participate in this before it gets to be unwieldy and the protocol starts to suffer?
Right. Well, the way we built our network, it can actually scale up pretty high because you have – some number of nodes who are like the mesh nodes and the infrastructure of this network, and you only need, you know, a few of them that are geographically dispersed, like, you know, within range of each other, but doesn't have to be every single person on the network. Then below them, you have all the users who just connect to it like it's a hotspot in a cafe, and they still have access to the entire mesh network, but they don't have to run the software. And so by having a few people who are running it in as infrastructure, they you're limiting the number of total nodes on the mesh network. So we've had more than 50 mesh nodes working at a time, and you can have about 150 clients on each one of those. So we think it could scale pretty well. And then, of course, you have some segment of those mesh nodes who are also gateways, who have an internet connection that they're sharing. And, the more of those, the better. But even if you only have two or three people who are sharing internet, everyone on the mesh gets internet.
So how is this different from Tor, then?
So Tor operates at a higher layer on the OSL mm-hmm. OSI model. We're at layer 3, and Tor is at like layer 4 and 5. So they're above us, and if we don't have layers 1 through 3 working, then Tor can't really do anything.
So in theory, you could use them in conjunction too. Is that possible?
Yeah. You could run Tor over top of our network. A lot of people have said, like, what about all these other mesh technologies? And some of them actually are mesh, and some of them just use the mesh name. But Tor and Freenet and CJDNS, they're all operating at a higher layer on the OSI model. And so we're solving like the base connectivity layer that's right below them, and we create that network that they can operate over top of.
Which we make jokes about as zombie apocalypse, but in a situation like Egypt, that could be really useful.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Travis, I think you want to make some additional points about hacker and makerspaces?
I guess I just wanted to clarify something, because we've come across with the topic of classes pretty strong here. And it really is a big part of what a makerspace can offer a community of hackers, which is some structured learning around topics that people are excited about. But while we've talked a lot about it, it is only a part of what goes on there. Like, for instance, if you're a member of Nova Labs, you get a key, and you've got 24/7 access to it. The other day, I wanted to get some help calibrating the Z-axis on my 3D printer. So I just said to one of my friends from Makerspace, can you meet me there? We'll spend a couple hours doing it. And we get together and do things whenever, we're moved to do it. This is a collaborative workspace with lots of tools. Classes are an important part of that, but it is really just a low double-digit fraction percentage of what we do.
Well, so, who was the guy who actually hacked into his BMW and sent out this sort of desperate email to the chatter list for Nova Labs? Somebody help me!
I love what happens in these spaces. This guy got a mini, and he got a card that allowed him to tap into the bus structure and to be able to then start tweaking with parameters in his car. And if a special interest group within our makerspace doesn't develop out of this, I'll be surprised, because people swarm around him. They all talk about it. They've all got cars. They want to know, how it's done, whether their car can do it, what kinds of variables can be tweaked, what kinds of things people are doing. It people just geek out on it, and that's a lot of what fuels the place.
That's great. And so your
I know a bunch of young men who do that with their Subaru WRXs, because they can chip out the electronic ignition.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, well, it sounds really great until the engines pop, because what they normally do, they try and run the engines really, really in, like, full on. In the WRX is pretty well engineered towards the top of its things, and if you actually run them faster and hotter, because they go faster as they get hotter, they actually usually pop after about a year's solid use.
There is a reason. But it will be so much fun in the meantime.
Well, according to the police officers I was talking to about it, they said, yes, we spend most of our time pulling them out of trees. So usually dead, because they make the cars go so fast. What happens is the engine goes so fast that suspension can't handle it. If you're not, you can upgrade the engine performance, but if you do that, you actually need to change the suspension, because a car's handling changes radically and outside of the safety parameters. So you chip up the engine without doing new wheels or new suspension or new roll bars. You've got to get the roll infrastructure correct, so that when you turn in, and you've got to have the wheel. Anyway, all these, he said, most of the time they'd just chip up the car and it'd go really fast, and then they'd drive into a wall or a tree or a power pole or something like that.
Get Explain that bent. To the insurance company.
Yeah, well, the insurance company stopped insuring cars that chipped up and wouldn't pay out. Yeah. Be careful.
Right.
So, Travis, your daughter is going to engineering school. Did you mention that?
Yeah, that's I guess another thought I had that might be of interest. My daughter, you know, as a proud father might say, you know, was really good in math and science and is heading off to engineering school. But I got a little bit worried. She hadn't actually done a whole lot of engineering. And I know when I went and got my engineering degree, I started off in one path, found myself disillusioned and ended up going in a completely different path of engineering. And I didn't want her to necessarily have to go through that stumble along the way, that frustration. And so I at least wanted to have some experience with she's going to be studying structural engineering at UCSD, San Diego. And I wanted to do some things with prototyping. And so we got her set up so that she went through and learned to use all the CNC tools. So there was the vinyl cutter, the 3D printer, the laser cutter, and the CNC mill. And she made everything from laser cutting pictures and putting logos on glasses to using the CNC mill to cut wood for building stools. She made the actual sign that we have on the front of Nova Labs, which is a three-layer vinyl cut project. And then she did some individual projects in terms of writing up documentation so that other people knew how to use the 3D printer, for instance. And we have a parade of families come through. We are, of course, a little bit concerned about safety. Safety and training are a big part of what we deal with when someone first comes into the space. And we don't really let kids use our tools independently. But this is a great opportunity for people to have their kids get exposed to making. Like, for instance, next Thursday, I think it is, we're having a make it and break it day. And it seems as though every parent wants their kids to be able to come in and just tear things apart, you know, to take that PC apart, to disassemble that router, to take that microwave apart. There's a part of, there's almost a litmus test you can do for makers, which is to say, you know, were you ever at any stage in your growing up really regular disassembler of things? Did you find yourself taking apart the clock in the kitchen or disassembling the toaster or things like that? Because it is a strain of curiosity that people have. And if a family wants their kid to get exposed to not only that side of things, but also the tools for making things, then a makerspace, at least so far as the classes are concerned, are a great way to go. And we have...
Better they should do it there than at home, right?
Right. And, I mean, some of this can be really mind-opening. Like, for instance, we're starting our third 3D printer build group. We build a model of the RepRap called the Prusa. And so far we've built 20 of them. We have a new class of 14 people, and two of the people in that class are kids. Now, they're going to learn all about Arduinos. They're going to learn about stepper control. They're going to learn about three-axis milling. They're going to be participating in a process where, over the course of many weeks, people around them are going to be getting together on a weekly basis or two times per week basis to progress through this process. First build the mechanicals, then do the electricals, then do the calibration, make sure everything's working. And one day, a guy is really good at the mechanical side of things, and all of a sudden he runs into a wall and can't go ahead and calibrate his Z-axis for his Prusa. And it is such a helpful process for a person of any age, but especially kids, to know that there are experts that they can rely on to help them through the course of a project. And so this has just been a really great vehicle for kids getting exposed to making and for finding out whether or not they have a basic interest. Because once you set that spark on the fire, if it takes, then you've got somebody who's going to be self-propelled. But in today's schools, at least in the United States, there's not a lot of making opportunity in schools. We've gone all safety and virtual, and, you know, there's the traditional book and classroom lecture and test, but not a lot of making. So where do you find that? At this moment in time, an emerging option seems to be makerspaces. So I just wanted to throw that extra thought in there. Safety is always a big issue, but where can kids go to learn some of these things? Well, in some of the structured programs that makerspaces have, that's a pretty nice option.
And it's not just this. I mean, Alice brought up one of the members of Nova Labs. She brought up some neuroscience experiments with live cockroaches. which made some of the people on the list cringe, but they're genuinely interesting experiments. And so I guess your point is that if you want to get kids and everybody excited about science, this a hackerspace or a makerspace is certainly a way to do that. Well, maybe on that note, we can talk about, so what's the first thing? Now we've gotten everybody excited about joining a hacker or makerspace or even starting their own. Can anybody suggest where they should start? I mean, I started with hackerspaces.org. I thought that was a great resource. Is that, anybody else have any good ideas about that?
I think that's definitely a great resource. I think, you know, whenever people ask me, you know, from, you know, other areas, you know, about hackerspaces, that's where I go to say, you know, like, well, look, there's a couple in your area that you might want to visit and check out.
Yeah, it's a great reference. I'd also throw in, though, that if you're just curious about the kinds of creative making that's going on, there are a litany of websites. I'm sure people on this call here can toss in a few extras, but there's Hackaday, and there's always wonderful stuff being done there, and it sort of gets your juices flowing. There's the Megzine blog, where you can end up seeing interesting ideas pointed to or interesting articles being written on a regular basis. You guys from HackDC, what would you throw in as additional resources on the web that can really sort of get the juices flowing and get you leaning forward in terms of, oh, damn, I'd like to do that. Like, what's a good Arduino site, for instance?
Oh, man. I don't know about Arduino sites, but in terms of, like, 3D printing things, I love just browsing Thingiverse and just looking at projects people have done already and things that I can do in the future with the 3D printers that are available to me. It's really fun and sparks a ton of interest.
I saw a great one. Somebody posted it to chat or the IKEA hacking site.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I love that one.
It's very practical. I mean, just how people have tricked out IKEA furniture, and it was amazing, some of the things they had done. I was really impressed. And some of them were really beautiful. It was great.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Fantastic.
Just today on Instructables, I found it's an idea for like a 3D printable knife sharpener that you print out this piece of plastic and stick it on the bottom of your coffee mug, and it uses the ceramic of the coffee mug as the sharpener surface, and the 3D print acts as an angle guide for your knife.
That's so cool.
It's so cool. Ethan's so quiet, probably because he's taking notes.
What's funny, you guys were talking about the kid who takes everything apart, and I was that kid. There's a pair of binoculars that has never gone back together again, because when I was 6 or 8 years old, the lens unscrews. Oh, there's all this glass inside. Oh, they don't work anymore, and that's kind of where it ended up.
Now hide it from mom and dad.
There's a reason I didn't bring up the putting it back together again. Even when it's done, there are often pieces left over. So,
there's always another one somewhere else, I guess. You know.
Well, I love that I found this great 10 Rules for Students, Teachers, and Life by John Cage. And it's an art thing. A lot of theater companies will have it hanging up. And I remember I sent it to Travis the other day, and I said, this doesn't sound like art at all. This sounds like it's applicable to makerspaces. And because Rule 6, for example, nothing is a mistake. There's no win and no fail. There's only make. Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good list.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, I don't even see the line anymore. Hacker and makerspaces are much more like an artisan workshop now than a traditional, you know, oh, geeks without, they don't have imaginations, they don't make, they don't create, they just, you know, find circuits and build things, you know, that are practical. But the line seems much blurrier. Do you feel that way, or is that just my perspective?
I think that the line never really existed. I think that, you know, that hacking has always been creative, and it's only recently that people are starting to recognize and acknowledge that.
Leonardo, the first hacker.
At HackDC, there's been a huge influx of traditional artists, like installation artists, who've been coming into our space asking for help for like building new installations and things like that. The most recent one went up at Flashpoint Gallery in DC, which was like this really interesting set of knit textiles that were hung from the ceiling, hooked up to Arduinos with, I believe they were IR Rangers. Yeah, they were IR Rangers and stepper motors. So when you walked by them, it would cause these like beautiful tapestries to textiles to like grow and shrink while you walked by. They kind of had this cool breathing motion, but they did like everything in our workshop for their installation. They learned how to use a lathe to like machine the little spools that they were using, and they learned Arduino software so they could program it and stuff. And it was to the point where a few HackDC members even helped install the piece. And it's like really neat collaborations in the art world have been popping up a lot with us.
Oh, that's great. That's
and
great.
Almost yeah. as a symbol of that, I mean, the origins of the Arduino were out of a design school in Italy, where the folks who were doing the design really wanted to be able to inject some intelligence into their creations. But, you know, injecting intelligence usually required some sort of processor board and a relatively big investment and relatively steep curves for climbing. Well, the Arduino is nothing but a simple controller. And since it was done open source and everybody was able to contribute on both the hardware and software, and libraries were being built all around the world, artists started to use Arduinos in their projects to create things. And there are all sorts of variations in Arduinos. There's the lily pad, which tends to be used in clothing. There's the teeny weeno, or whatever it's called. It's much smaller and can be used in much smaller housings. And it makes technology and control so much more accessible to artists. And when artists want access to it, it brings the technology community so much closer and allows technologists to express themselves in artistic ways as well. So I think that there is a lot of truth to that. And you see it in larger makerspaces like, the Crucible out in Oakland, or the Artist Asylum up in Boston, that you see much more of all flavors of the rainbow there, from very art to very technical, all collaborating in this space and really creating some wonderful things.
Well, I think by bringing everybody together like this, you know, a lot of people in the IT profession complain about burnout. I mean, we're forced to do, you know, we get into a grind of doing the same thing over and over again, the same ways. I think this allows us to express ourselves creatively, which I believe engineering is really, it's a creative medium. I mean, it's considered part of the creative economy. And, you know, and from as a security professional, it also allows me to not just be in the no club and the break it club. It allows me to be in the build it club and find solutions to security problems, which can be very exciting and very inspiring in a career that sometimes is missing that aspect. I don't know how you, Greg, how do you and Ethan feel about that?
There's an element of creativity that I think goes missing a lot, especially in the corporate grind jobs like you were talking about, because creativity in artistry comes with a certain element of risk. And what corporations tend to like are the tried and true, we know how this works, get it done kind of a thing. And Michelle, you were talking a little bit ago about we do the same thing over and over again. Yeah, I just finished a project this week that was yet another iteration of something I've done over and over again, implementing a firewall and doing an audit and implementing rules and then dealing with all the users screaming because they can't do what they used to be able to do now that we put the firewall in place. You know, creativity and artistry, you know, I got creative with the colors I used in my Visio diagram, and that was about what it was. You know, it's not especially rewarding in that regard, you know? So to be able to go out and, well, like even right now, we're recording a podcast. There's a creative element there that I find very satisfying, and it's one of the reasons I like being able to engage in social media and podcasting in that way, because it is an outlet, and I think it's something that all of us that like to build things and put things together really have that inner urge to make happen, and a lot of times the day-to-day job you just can't.
And that inner urge being satisfied, that in the case of making, and there are many forms of making, but in the case of actually producing something with your hands, it seems so basic to who we are. And when you can do it and you've produced something at the end of a day that actually you can hold in your hand, or you can feel pride in having produced, it's remarkably rewarding. And I mean, I remember spending weeks at a time coming home and wondering, what in the heck did I really accomplish, right? Well, if I can add a dousing of making into the mix, I can end up feeling that sense of accomplishment of getting something done. There is something rewarding about working with your hands and producing things. And while that's been true forever, most of the time throughout history, it's been kind of kept at bay from your average man because you end up having to spend so much time learning the craft. Well, nowadays with personal fabrication technologies and going from software through to computer controlled tools, so much more is possible. And that's really part of the revolution that's taking place right now.
That's great. I think we've covered a lot of territory here, and I hope everybody's really excited about going out and joining a hackerspace or a makerspace or supporting one or starting their own if they're in a place that doesn't have one. If you've gone to hackerspaces.org and you just don't have one, I mean, it doesn't take a lot, I think, to start one. You should have all the resources you need. I'd like to just go around the room so everyone can indulge in a little shameless self-promotion now and find out what everybody's doing. Why don't we start with Ben?
I'm still really heavily focused on Byzantium and making that a success, but also just running classes at HackDC, teaching Introduction to Computer Science.
Great. And how can we find you on Twitter?
Twitter at Sitwon, SITWON, and I'm often hanging out at HackDC, and Byzantium, you can find out more at projectbyzantium.org.
Or if you want to contribute, if you want to be a code contributor,
yeah,
I know you need those. Yeah.
Yes, we do. We're on GitHub if you'd like to. There's links from the website. We're on GitHub. We need people to download it, test it, play around. Send us emails. We have a mailing list, byzantium@hackdc.org. Let us know what you think and, find bugs because we like the bugs we know about. We can fix this.
Brad?
What am I up to? What projects am I working on?
Yeah, promote yourself shamelessly.
Oh, goodness. shamelessly. Well, I've just been trying to focus a lot on community outreach for HackDC, working on a bunch of different projects with artists in the area. I've been working with eTextiles myself, playing with my... I recently learned how to weave, which is a lot of fun. So I'm working with knits and weaves and trying to work electronics into them. And there's the regular software crap that I do. But, yeah.
How can
mostly
we find
that
you
sort
on,
of stuff.
Can we find you on Twitter?
I don't have a Twitter presence. I know.
Well, we can find you hanging out at HackDC, right?
Absolutely. I'm there all the time.
And you guys, HackDC is on Freenode as well, right?
Yep. #HackDC.
Great. Travis, where can we find you?
I'll just drop a couple of URLs. I'm a contributing editor to Make Magazine, so you can see some of the things I write on magazine.com. Also, there's the makerspace that I've been making reference to, which is just a few miles from HackDC here in Northern Virginia. It's at nova-labs.org. And then for what's going on with me, I tend not to be too disciplined about my Twittering, but I'm very good about my blogging, so that would be at goodpursuits.com.
And all of this will be in the show notes, so
great.
Everybody can find it there. Greg, what will you be working on this week?
Trying to stay alive. I'm just finishing up writing an analyst report for Information Week. I'm also working on some training material for Cisco's UCS products, and I'm working during the day for a financial institution designing their security infrastructure. So between those things and having the odd beer tonight, it's Young's Double Chocolate Stout, which I can thoroughly recommend because it really does taste like chocolate.
Here, here.
Of course, it is 8:15 where I am, so bottoms up. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. I also have a Twitter account at etherealmind. And don't forget to check out whatever it is we're going to say on Packet Pushes in the next week or two. Cheers, everybody.
Ethan?
So I've got Cisco Nexus gear that is finally going to go live this week, unless I postpone it again for a third week, because the last 2 weeks I just haven't been able to quite pull it off with the other projects I've had going. I just moved into new office space in my house, meaning the Packet Pushers U.S. North American recording studio needs to actually get turned into a studio. This room's a little boomy, and actually I'll admit that while we were recording, I was shopping for acoustic foam to put in this room to tone it down just a little bit. I'm going to make myself a little home office recording studio sort of a thing going on. That and I have to make better drainage in the front of my house, because I had some water leak into my basement for the first time in 12 years of living here, and I've got to make something like gutters and a drain well, and I'm not sure what all I'm going to be doing yet. So anyway, you can find me on Twitter at ecbanks, and if I'm blogging, I'm doing it probably at packetpushers.net. I have a personal blog too. If you search on Google, you can find that if you want to see me blogging about something other than networks.
God forbid. and I'm on the Twitter. This is Michelle Chaburka. I'm on the Twitter at MrsYisY. You can also see me blogging at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening, and hope you can follow us on the Twitter at Packet Pushers or join the Borg Collective on IRC at Freenode. Visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the growing Packet Pushers community, subscribe to our RSS feeds, or donate to the show. Email your comments or questions about this show to packetpushers@gmail.com or healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. A closing technical tip: if you set your phaser to stun, it's great for making popcorn. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Starfleet and the United Federation of Planets. They're looking for a few good humanoids or otherwise sentient beings to join the team. Finally, remember that it's healthy paranoia, because sometimes they really are out to get you.